Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The unknown here is how much the supporters for the various candidates are going to turn out. Will the Trump supporters really be as faithful to him and as loyal to him as everybody's expecting?
The U.S. Republican Party holds its party caucus on Monday.
Staff have a number of grievances. These relate to the unfair treatment in terms of how they are paid. There is discrimination in payment where staff at a section of staff at Makerere University are being underpaid.
Workers from Makerere University will decide on Monday whether to embark on a strike.
The best of the entire continent, because this is truly bringing together through sports the entirety of Africa.
The U.S. Embassy in Ivory Coast works closely with the West African nation during the AFCON. We'll have details, those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. As Democrats shift their presidential preference caucus to mail-in balloting in Iowa with incumbent President Joe Biden the likely winner, Republicans take center stage during Iowa's 2024 caucus when supporters assemble in person to choose their candidate for the Republican nomination. VOA's Kane Farabaugh has more from Iowa.
First, the snow. Then bitter cold temperatures iced out campaign events in the state of Iowa the weekend before the January 15th caucus. Former President Donald Trump canceled most of his in-person events. Former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley also moved many of her events online.
I think it'll make the non-passionate people stay home and the passionate people will come out.
Bad weather didn't prevent Carson Odell from attending one of the few in-person events Florida Governor Ron DeSantis didn't cancel. Cheryl Weisheit also braved the snowstorm to hear DeSantis' campaign pitch.
Early on, it wasn't that bad. I don't know, we're just so used to this.
Weisheit, who also chairs a local Republican group, says physically attending an event was important to her because she still doesn't know who to support on caucus night.
I don't know yet, and I probably won't know till that night.
This is some of the heaviest snow and certainly some of the coldest temperatures that have happened in Iowa around a caucus in many years. And so the question now is, how much is this going to impact turnout?
The unknown here is how much the supporters for the various candidates are going to turn out. Will the Trump supporters really be as faithful to him and as loyal to him as everybody's expecting?
University of Iowa political science professor Tim Hagel says if polling translates into turnout, it's more difficult for other Republicans vying to unseat Trump as the frontrunner on caucus night. And it curbs their ability to pick up momentum as the race moves beyond Iowa.
If Trump is still 30 points ahead or maybe even more, then it would seem pretty unlikely that DeSantis or Haley is going to be able to beat him or even come in close, because to a certain extent they're dividing the anti-Trump vote.
Hagel adds that polling also shows Trump's legal troubles haven't dampened his support.
Given that he was indicted in four different places, he's got a civil trial going on in New York, he's got a defamation trial going on there as well, states are trying to kick him off the ballot. All this means, in the eyes of a lot of his supporters, is that they're politically persecuting him. And so there's a rally around the chief effect that's going on.
But there are signs of fatigue among Iowa voters. Retired police officer John Frank supported Trump before, but not this year.
He's getting of an age, just like Joe Biden, that we've got to consider that. And he's never learned over his life, and especially his political life, to keep his mouth shut.
Frank says he'll caucus for DeSantis. Cheryl Weisheit has narrowed her choice down to DeSantis and Haley, but not Trump.
Well, if Trump is the candidate, then I'm all on board. But right now, you know, he's not the one that I will caucus for.
We often see some movement right up until caucus night.
Which is why Hagel says turnout is key when Iowa Republican voters gather in person to caucus for their candidate of choice. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Des Moines, Iowa.
In Uganda, workers at Makerere University plan on making a decision Monday whether to embark on a strike. The unions representing the workers, including the Makerere University Academic Staff Association, or MUASA, say the strike is needed to press on their demands for improved pay and working conditions. They contend that compared to other public universities, workers at Makerere, the country's premier university, are not equally paid. They also say the school has failed to resolve the pay disparity for more than 10 years. It comes as school authorities plead with parliament to resolve workers' demands. Dr. Robert Kakuru, president of the Makerere University Academic Staff Association, or MUASA, tells me that failure to resolve their concerns is the major reason behind the union's decision to embark on the strike.
Staff have a number of grievances. These relate to the unfair treatment in terms of how they are paid. There is discrimination in payment where staff at a section of staff at Makerere University are being underpaid. These are both academic, administrative, and support staff. And our concerns have always been presented to government and to the university council. So on November 30th, we had the General Assembly that gave an extension of a notice of industrial action that is expiring today. There are a number of emerging issues that we have to present to the staff tomorrow. We have had a meeting with the university management. We had a meeting with the chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Education and Sports on Friday. There are a number of emerging issues that we shall present to the staff tomorrow at 11 a.m. in a joint staff association general assembly. From that presentation, staff will choose whether to go on strike or not.
Well, but Dr. Kakuru, I understand the chancellor of the university is calling on workers, including the academic staff, not to embark on a strike as they try to resolve your concerns. Are you going to hold off until they resolve your concerns before embarking on strike?
I'm a leader, and as a leader, I derive my mandate from the members. My role is to guide the members to arrive at an informed decision. But if members choose otherwise, my role is to present the grievances as they are raised to the university management and to the university council.
So on what basis are you saying that the staff are not being paid properly? Or on what basis?
We are comparing with other public universities in the same country. We are established by law, and there are many public universities in Uganda. And a section of staff at Makerere University are being underpaid compared to their counterparts in other public universities, and we think this is unfair. For example, you find a chief technician at Makerere University is paying on a lower scale than a chief technician in Chambogo University and other public universities.
What do you say to those who are saying you should actually engage with the authorities of the university as well as the government to resolve your concerns instead of threatening, they said, on embarking on this strike to press home your demands?
Yes, the reason why we are doing this is that we have been presenting these matters around 2015-17, and these are matters that have been on the table for long. Even before the current financial year, government issued a harmonized salary structure, which we thought that the university would implement in the current financial year. But to our surprise, funds were never allocated in the current financial year to address this problem. So that's why we are saying that we need to have this matter addressed once and for all, because it has been on for close to 10 years now.
So this notice of industrial action or warning to the authorities at the Makerere University, what has been their responses so far since you started engaging them?
The first response was that the Minister of Public Service produced a harmonized salary structure for all public universities, and we expected funds to be allocated in the current financial year, which was not done. But we have gotten some assurances from the university management and the parliament that this problem is being addressed. And so far, that is what we have received, but though not concrete in nature, that this problem will be addressed in the next financial year. We believe that if there are tangible commitments to address this problem, then we shall be comfortable. But if it's not done that way, or if staff develop some cold feet about that, then it will be very problematic. But we believe that the assurances we have gotten from the investor management and from Parliament that this problem will be addressed.
Dr. Robert Kakuru is president of the Makerere University Academic Staff Association. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Still in Uganda, a leading member of the opposition National Unity Platform is expressing concern about the reappointment of Justice Simon Byabakama as chairperson of the Electoral Commission. Parliamentarian Helen Nachimuli says Ugandans must demand that in future polls, Byabakama must administer free, fair and transparent elections. Her comments come after President Yoweri Museveni sent a letter to the Speaker of Parliament confirming the reappointment of the head of the Electoral Commission. He also selected four new commissioners to the electoral body. Parliament is expected to soon begin the vetting process before confirmation. Opposition groups have often accused Byabakama of failing to organize credible polls, accusations he strongly rejects. To learn more about opposition concerns, I reach parliamentarian Helen Nachimuli.
You see, elections usually happen after 5 years. And every time we approach that period, we are worried because we know this person is not trustworthy. He may be trustworthy to the appointing authority, but not to the people. We have seen quite a number of times elections being rigged and nothing has been done. They say, no, it was free and fair because this is something they have crammed to say.
Why are you saying the people do not trust him to organize free and fair credible elections? Because the opposition, on the other hand, must be part of protecting the votes of the individuals. In order to ensure part of the transparency, supporters of the NRM argue that it's not a one-way street. Both groups would have to ensure that the process is transparent.
You see, this is how we have participated. We have sat and come about with electoral reform. This is our contribution. This is how it should be done. The appointing authority should be different. It shouldn't be an intending candidate for a forthcoming election to, you know, be the one that is going to, you know, appoint an electoral commission. It must be independent of its own. So we do not want to see an intending candidate in a forthcoming election appointing the electoral commission. It means this commission is going to work for his benefit, for his interest. It will be working in his interest. What the opposition has done is to bring an alternative. How should it have been done? And this has been, you know, trashed. This is our input as opposition. And also, when it comes to election, the opposition does a lot because we are in it also. At the end of the day, what do we do? Because this is somebody who has organized an election, he thinks it's free and fair. We go in, we battle, and somehow others win and others don't, especially at the lower part, for example, MPs, LC5, and all that.
Does that mean the electoral reforms the opposition is asking for would have to be a constitutional change, because the constitution gives the president the ability to make appointments and then are vetted by parliament. So people in parliament have the ability to either approve or disapprove of the president's appointment.
What we thought would happen was a constitution amendment. And while in there, we of course insert the constitutional reforms, but this they have refused. And also, we have the appointments committee in the parliament, which is headed by the Speaker of Parliament. When people are appointed, they're not go to the floor of parliament to be debated. We have different ideas, but some of which ideas will not be captured in the appointments committee. Of course, we even have opposition members of parliament on that committee. But you know, people are different. People have different interests. Everyone will have their issues. So we have faith in some of our members of parliament who are on that committee, but not all of them are from the opposition. And you know, some of them are from the NRM when they're told we must see this one through, and that will be it. Our country is almost going to the dogs because of a lot of corruption, you know. So I know the systems here, most of them are rotten. Even the president should do the right thing. According to the constitution, what does it say? Yes, the constitution gives him that authority. But we are saying, can we have reforms? Because the constitution gave him too much power.
By your estimation, do you think the reappointed chairman of the Electoral Commission will be approved by Parliament in spite of what you described as your concerns about him?
If the appointing authority wants him, he will definitely influence and he will go through, trust me.
Helen, as a member of Parliament from the opposition, will you engage the reappointed chairman of the Electoral Commission and ask him about the need to ensure that the next general election will be free, fair, transparent, and credible, since you seem to have concerns about that?
In fact, Peter, as the newly appointed Information and Anti-Corruption Shadow Minister, I will ensure I do that, because I think it will be my responsibility to speak to this gentleman, make a statement, let it go to him. But, you know, these guys know what exactly to do, but they do otherwise because there's somebody above them saying, hello, you have to do this. There's always that voice telling them to do otherwise. Yeah, but I'll do my part, and you'll see it happen.
Helen Nachimuli is a leading member of the opposition National Unity Platform. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Human Rights Watch is expressing concern about the, quote, meager international assistance and lack of civilian protection in the war in Sudan and the challenges facing Ethiopia. The international rights group says although there have been efforts to provide assistance, they've not gone far enough. The concerns were contained in the Africa chapter of the group's World Report 2024. It highlights Human Rights Watch's work in Africa, as well as what it says is the global inaction on wartime atrocities and the humanitarian crisis in the Horn of Africa region. For more on the study, I reach Mausi Shegun. She is the executive director of Human Rights Watch's Africa division.
The international community has not deployed the mechanisms that are essential for ensuring that civilians do not suffer unduly in the context of both of these crises. The second is access to humanitarian aid. In both contexts, whether you look at the first crisis that Ethiopia had, despite the cessation of hostilities agreement from November 2022, civilians there continue to suffer. And then you have the forces of the Amhara community still carrying out ethnically charged expulsion of Tigrayans from Western Tigray. That's in Ethiopia. Sudan is an ongoing crisis, both in Khartoum, but also especially in West Darfur, to be precise, and more recently, South Darfur as well. The communities there have been targeted by Arab militias and the rapid support forces, targeting specifically ethnic Masalit men and women.
What about West and Central Africa coups and pandemic? We've had recent attempts at coups, particularly in West Africa. Talk to me about that.
You know, West Africa has been particularly precarious in terms of human rights over the last few years. But the ongoing crisis, mostly characterized by armed Islamist insurgency and the very hard-headed and violent government response, has led to widespread human rights abuses, including displacement, arbitrary arrest, attacks on entire communities in retaliation for the attack of the armed insurgents. And so this situation is now being compounded by the military intervention or takeover. I try not to call them coups, but that's exactly what they are. With the attendant human rights challenges, such as, you know, as any politically unstable situation would throw up, including arrest of civil society actors, political actors, the shutdown of critical freedom of expression space, including that of the media, arrest and detention, as we've seen, for example, in the case of Niger, where, you know, even the steps taken by the economic community of West African states to try to normalize that situation has been rebuffed, not just by Niger, but it triggered some response from its neighboring countries, where the juntas there decided in Burkina Faso and Mali.
Now, in Southern Africa, there are concerns about historical challenges that include political instability, freedom of expression, association, equal participation, related to free and fair elections. Talk to me briefly about this.
Governments in the region continue to suppress political opposition. They are continuing to restrict and constrict civic space. The independent journalists are unable to or critics, those who even just want to comment on decisions and policy making by the authorities face repression, they face harassment, detention, and as we've seen in cases like Eswatini, direct attack on their physical attacks on them, and in some cases the killing and extrajudicial killing and execution in ways that have been difficult for even law enforcement or independent investigators to unravel. Zimbabwe is a key example with the general elections there last August and the by-elections in December were characterized by horrible atrocities, kidnapping, torture, killing of opposition members, activists, human rights defenders. As a matter of fact, I would go as far as saying even having our team in those countries, especially Zimbabwe, for example, has become almost impossible because their safety cannot be guaranteed. That is how closed that society has become.
Mao Sishegun is the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Africa Division. She spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. It's the second day of the Africa Cup of Nations, or AFCON, underway in Ivory Coast. My colleague Mugbe Yabaro, who is on a special assignment to cover the tournament, caught up with the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, Jessica Davis-Ba, at the embassy in Abidjan. He began by asking about her thoughts on Ivory Coast hosting the AFCON tournament, including if the opening ceremony lived up to her expectations, and much more.
Ambassador, how is it when you first heard about AFCON coming to Abidjan? Just explain to us a little bit about the feeling that you had.
Even before I arrived here in Abidjan, I knew that the Africa Cup of Nations would be coming here. And I was thrilled that I'd be able to be here in place to be able to witness really what is a historic event. It is something that our team has been focused on for months and how we can best accompany Côte d'Ivoire, in particular all Ivoirians, to ensure that we support it in the best way possible, this moment to really highlight the best of Côte d'Ivoire and also the best of the entire continent, because this is truly bringing together through sports the entirety of Africa.
Just continuing on that point, just going off on a tangent, did that expectation, did you feel like you lived up to it yesterday in the opening ceremony?
Yesterday was beautiful. The opening ceremony was amazing. It was inspirational. It was exciting. You could see the cultures reflected from across the continent. But yesterday was the culmination of months, if not years, of preparation that Côte d'Ivoire has been making. The infrastructure investments, the investments in bolstering security, the investments in ensuring that they had medical care standing by, the investments to ensure that all people could participate either in person or virtually. So this this was a real culmination of efforts from across the continent and truly across the world. And we could see it as a global event and putting Cote d'Ivoire on the global stage where it belongs. And so we recognized, all of us, that not only did it meet, but it absolutely surpassed our expectations. And we were thrilled to see the success of it.
That's amazing. On that point, having the State Department send a delegation, a sports delegation that has three prominent women in American sports, what is that like for you seeing that for this AFCON tournament?
It was really an opportunity for us to express the way in which the United States is partnering with Cote d'Ivoire to be able to show up in all ways, including through sports, and to be able to show up with three Olympic gold medal winners, three women who are at the top of their game and who have really transformed the world of sports. And so that's really for us a way to be able to, during this match, highlight the ways in which the United States and members of the African diaspora have transformed not just the sports world, but the world across different cultural industries. The fact that they were representing the President's Council on African Diaspora Engagement was hugely significant for us, so that we could show the full diversity of America, which corresponds to the full diversity of Cote d'Ivoire and this continent. And so in this delegation, in this match, and in this historic moment, we were able to show up with the best that America is.
Thank you.
Jessica Davis-Barr is the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast. He spoke with my colleague Mugbe Yarborough from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan. In Guinea-Bissau, a leading member of the opposition coalition PAI, Terra Ranka, says the group is preparing documents for a petition to the international community to help resolve the country's political challenges. Agnello Regala, a member of the recently dissolved parliament, says regional bloc ECOWAS, the African Union and the United Nations are some of the organizations that will receive the petition. His remarks come after supporters of the party called on President Umaru Sissoco Embalo to reconsider his decision to dissolve parliament. Upon his return from a trip abroad, the president dissolved the legislature following what he said was a coup attempt. For more on the call for international assistance to help resolve the political challenges facing Guinea-Bissau, I reach Agnello Regala.
We are in demonstration because the president decided to dissolute the parliament, and we are trying to oblige him to respect the constitution and to restore the constitutional legacy, you know. That's the reason.
Now that you've gone on demonstration, what's the next line of action?
Following the demonstrations, you are preparing a document to present to the international community, to try to sensibilize the international community and the organization like the United Nations, ECOWAS, and the African Union to come and to try to solve this, because before it comes a very big, very bad situation for them.
Why wouldn't your party engage the president to resolve this problem?
He is the president, really. But the constitution we have here a semi-presidential constitution. You have the principle of separation of powers. You have the president, the parliament, and the government, and the court. You have four powers that are sovereign and independent. That's why the people tell him to respect the principle of separation of power. The assembly is another power, different than his power.
Supporters of the president are saying that calling on the international community, including ECOWAS, to come in is undermining the sovereignty of Guinea-Bissau.
is not violating, because when we decide to integrate the ECOWAS, we give them some power to try to help us to solve our problems internally. That's not a question of sovereignty, because we belong to ECOWAS. ECOWAS are not coming to impose something. ECOWAS is coming to help us to find a solution, because between the party, the coalition that win the elections, and the president, there's no dialogue. That's why.
But there was an attempted coup.
There's no. The one, because the problem between two forces, armed, the National Guard and the Presidential Guard, is not a problem of the parliament. What the parliament has in this situation? There was a problem, and two forces fight each other. It was not a decision of the parliament.
Agnello Regala is a member of the recently dissolved Guinea-Bissau parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Bissau. In Nigeria, the former general manager of Peter Obi's presidential campaign has resigned from the opposition Labour Party, citing incompatible ideological differences. Doyin Okupe says he now seeks to embark on a new political career. In reaction, the opposition party criticized the resignation, saying it was opportunistic. It adds that Okupe would have remained with the party had candidate Peter Obi won the presidential contest. For more on his decision to resign from the opposition party, I reached Doyin Okupe.
We went on a search of a political party that would accommodate us and accommodate our interests. And we found out that Labour was the most accommodating. So we went, with Labour Party, irrespective of their, political disposition. And as far as I'm concerned, after we have contested under Labour Party and we have lost the election, we did see Labour Party as a special purpose vehicle on which we can achieve our ambition to run for the presidency in for the presidential election. Now that that bid has failed, it became quite uncomfortable for me to continue to remain in Labour Party, because Labour Party is left of centre. It's a socialist party with socialist doctrine. My pedigree, my personal pedigree, is totally against anything that is, under socialism. I'm a born free enterprise advocate. I believe in liberal democracy, and I am right of center. So I'm just like a fish out of water. There's no way I could exist, further. In that party.
But Doyin, what do you say to your critics who are saying that was a really convenient way of trying to jump ship after you failed to win the presidency? You knew the Labour Party, yet because you wanted to become president, you worked towards it. Now that it failed, you are just finding an excuse to leave, and that is not loyal, they argue. Your response to that?
It was Peter Obi who wanted to be president.
Right.
I was just supporting Peter Obi. Politically, I'm a much, much, much senior person to Peter Obi in politics. But because of my zeal and passion that the Southeastern Nigeria should produce the president, and in my own assessment, Peter Obi was the best, that was why I supported Peter Obi. As for those who said I'm using an excuse, let them fault my reason. Yes, we knew. We knew that the Labour Party was a socialist party. But Peter and I, we debated it. There's no argument. Peter is a traitor. He says it everywhere that he's a traitor. A traitor is not a socialist. I am, I am a businessman and a free enterprise person. I'm not a socialist. But, you know, what we were hoping to do was that if God was on our side and we won the election, we will meet with Labour, where we will meet with the party and look for, you know, a median position on which you can form government. It will not be totally Labour or socialist, but it will certainly not be, you know, a leftist party. I have no apologies for those who are cynical. I'm 72 years old, and I should know what I want in politics. When I risked everything, I put everything I had, you know, and I left every reasonable pathway, and I supported, you know, a course that really did not have an obvious future. Nobody said anything. You know, people can always say anything they like. I've been in this game for over 40 years. I'm totally and absolutely unmoved.
So what is next for Doyin Okupe, the politician?
Peter, like I just told you, I'm 72. I'm just also recuperating from some illness. I will just take my time and rest for a while, and then thereafter I'll take a decision. But whatever I'm going to do henceforth will not be what I've done in the past. It's going to be more or less something like a statesman. You know, I am too old now to start to be an activist or to, you know, to carry a candidate on my head, you know, to do all this. You know, I cannot, even my body cannot take it. So I'll just, offer advisory role in whatever place I find myself, but I'll be more of a statesman.
You said you are 72-year-old, you've been in the game for so long, and that you are tired and all that. So that's why I'm asking.
No, I'm tired of, you know, actively, you know, contesting, competing and all that. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm going to another phase. So, you know, there's, you know, retirement is still quite a long way for me. I still have a lot to do and a lot to contribute to national development politically.
Doyin Okupe is a former general manager of Peter Obi's presidential campaign. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The fierce legal duel between two teams of legal specialists concluded its two-day trial on Friday. The setting was the 15 judges of the International Court of Justice, plus two other judges, one representing Israel and the other South Africa. It has been estimated that the results would not be known for an extended period lasting maybe 1 to 2 years. And it is for that reason that South Africa proposed provisional measures which they believe will bring an end to what they consider Israel's genocide campaign. But the Israeli councils have asked the courts to reject South Africa's provisional measures because, in their view, it will leave Israel defenseless. The main subject matter before the court is South Africa's allegation that Israel entered a campaign leading to genocide of the Palestinian people. And the Israeli team has denied the allegation. From all those who have been able to watch the proceedings for 2 days in The Hague, any attempt by me to detail the charges would be superfluous. Nevertheless, there were comments made during the formal proceedings that deserve urgent comments. The first is to say that many Africans and many others were taken aback at the negative portrait made against the government and people of South Africa. Whatever the current conditions of political economic problems in South Africa is, South Africa is held in high regard in the community of African states. For many, not only in Africa, but outside Africa, South Africa indeed has a high moral standing. Its leader, former President Nelson Mandela, showed to the world a high moral leadership. When Mandela was released from prison after decades in Robben Island, as he walked out the doors of the prison hand in hand with his wife, he showed to the world what good leaders can do. He made clear to his ANC comrades that with the end of apartheid, it is not the time to give almighty revenge because of the brutal way they were treated. But it will be the time for reconciliation and forgiveness. And so it was. And also, for those who know South Africa well, particularly the ANC, they will know that the comrades in the ANC have the highest regard for their Jewish comrade-in-arms who fought alongside them in dealing with the brutal regime of apartheid. So it is very difficult and for South Africans and Africans to hear that in presenting its genocide case before the world courts, the South African government, meaning the government and people, are demonstrating anti-Semitism and, sadly, the term blood libel. It was also sad that the South African government was seen as a mere spokesperson for Hamas, a terrorist group as they call it. But we should not forget, when speaking before the courts, that South Africa, the Hamas group, was not designated a terrorist group by the international community or the United Nations. It was designated a terrorist group according to the laws of the United States. One should not forget also that the great Nelson Mandela, when he was thrown into prison, was considered a terrorist along with the ANC. And believe it or not, Nelson Mandela remained in the books of the United States as a terrorist until 2008. So much more care should be taken when such words are bandied around, particularly before an international court. Let me also say that throughout the world, those who are protesting, they consider South Africa holding the moral ground. Because many have lost hope. They wondered why the international community have abandoned the Palestinians. And they gave South Africa a high mark for bringing this troublesome issue, which has lasted too long, before the international community. And finally, Africans, as many in the global community, in the global south, have become accustomed that they are dismissed with a wave of hand when they try to raise their votes in international fora. And it was surprising that so many developed governments in Europe and the United States were quick to dismiss South Africa's submission of the case before the World Court. But the South African team demonstrated before the world its capacity and ability to present a coherent case before the ICJ. So as we await what the court will do with the provisional measures, Africans in particular should feel contented that the South African government and people have demonstrated that the African continent can produce men and women of conscience. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
nasenda senda kati mpangute Fulana Ulikasike kani honda mmatima kwange kona kakuwade Kati tunyeze ya vulavu ya femu mpola Hibisu vizyo sabo viteke mkola Sigenda buku suwaza adi ya dotia Echa mazima otute mchala wapisa Na yetu alomu lonji yesi wakumi Nange siwe na kakuwe woningi Mwana wasiwa Tokezo kutuwa lano nisentula Ono mungole wakachacha Wege nileze abakaza walungi tuliwa kula Ono mungole wakachacha Kuali kigezo no karulolu hindi kulopa mbuga Ono mungole wakachacha Nusese mbalilite ebyo kucha wege tansubila Ono mungole wakachacha Jagala kusane nienga kunyama Zemuli mwaka nino kuzalira Lele o, aho Kusama kwa chako wano, aho Dala eviange vyelirio, aho Mazima tonde kanga o, aho Bela o, aho Kusama kwa chako wano, aho
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Fiona Nandudu Wamai and engineer Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, stealing the village drum is easy, but beating it is another issue. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.